Chapter 10. The force of the blast knocked Alice over in her chair, and she was still on the ground, coughing from dust and debris, when she saw innocent courtiers and civilians attacked by a mob of Red's Guard soldiers and fierce ex-Wonderlanders.
No!
A hand clamped over Alice's mouth. It was Dodge. He pulled her under the table with him.
Keep quiet or they'll get you too. Stay here and don't move.
Alice wasn't planning on moving. Not out from under the table, at any rate. Too much was happening, and none of it good. But Dodge was with her. She had him.
As long as Dodge and I stay together.
In the quarter moment after the explosion, General Doppelganger ran behind a thick curtain and pulled a lever attached to a crank, half buried in the floor. The black floor tiles of the room flipped over to reveal an army of white chessmen. Knights, rooks, bishops, pawns. The chessmen battled the invading Guard soldiers, blades swinging and bodies falling. General Doppelganger split into the twin figures of Generals Doppel and Ganger, and each of them split in two, so that now there were two General Doppels and two General Gangers battling Red soldiers. Not that Alice realized that the poisonous-looking woman who'd shouted, "Off with their heads!" was her Aunt Red. She hadn't made the connection yet, because...
Where was her mother?
There, fending off Red soldiers two and three at a time. Alice never knew her mother could fight. She flinched with each near hit Genevieve suffered, watching as the Queen imagined new weapons for herself, swords, sabres, spiked clubs, whenever one was knocked from her grip. She was always armed with four weapons at once, her imagination swinging two of them, to fend off attacks from behind. Why didn't she imagine the Guard soldiers dead? Alice tried doing it herself. She closed her eyes and pictured the soldiers piled in a lifeless heap in the centre of the room. Bibwit was not there to explain that by the power of imagination alone, nobody could kill a creature that had the will to live. When Alice opened her eyes, the room was still in chaos. White pawns and rooks and the occasional knight falling at the hands of the enemy. The cries of pain and defeat still filled her ears. A body slammed against the tabletop. Dodge put his arm around her, as if that could keep her from harm.
"Don't move, don't move," he whispered.
She huddled against him. She didn't want to watch any more, wanted to bury her face in Dodge's shoulder and lift it up again to find the horrid scene over. Everything as it used to be. Hatter Madigan removed his top hat. Holding it by the brim, he flicked his wrist hard and fast. The hat flattened and divided into a series of S-shaped rotary blades held together at the centre. He winged the weapon across the room, the blades spinning and slicing through the enemy before embedding themselves in the mortar at the far wall. One of Red's four Guards pulled the weapon out of the wall. But throwing Hatter's top hat required a technique not easily mastered. And every time the soldier tried employing the quick wrist flick he'd seen Hatter use, the weapon only clattered to the floor. Hatter fought his way toward the top hat, flipping and tumbling through the air, his long millinery coat flaring like a cape. His steel bracelets snapped open and became propeller blades on the outward side of his wrists. His backpack sprouted blades and corkscrews of various lengths and thicknesses, like an open Swiss Army knife. The forecard was growing more desperate as Hatter approached. The top hat clanged on the floor one last time. Hatter picked up the weapon, examining it to make sure it hadn't been damaged.
"One must learn how to use it," he said. "Here, let me show you the proper way."
These were the last words the soldier ever heard. Red strolled through the mayhem of the battle unharmed. Whenever a white pawn made the mistake of attacking her, she flicked him with a long, bony finger and sent him hurling into the stone walls or the pointed end of someone's spear. It gave her no small pride to see the cat performing so well in combat, poking fatal holes in chessmen with his claws, easily taking out as many of them as Hatter did Guard soldiers. She was also pleased to note the speed with which the suit families had fallen into obedience. No sooner had she ordered the removal of everyone's head than the Lord of Diamonds bravely stepped forward bowed and said, "Your Majesty, we regret that we've been deprived of your presence for so long, and rejoice that you've returned." The spades and clubs echoed him with bows and fond regards of their own. So she would let them live, for the moment. Besides, there was something intriguing about the young diamond boy. He stood under the protective arm of his father, seeming more interested than scared, as if learning all he could from the violence around him. Who knew? He might grow up to be useful. Sir Justice Anders cut and slashed at the invading card soldiers. He rescued several chessmen momentarily overpowered by a band of two cards, and when he spotted an opening toward the cat, he made a run at the creature, sword poised to strike. Dodge saw what was about to happen. "Watch this," he said to Alice, proud of his father's skills and bravery. But the cat had no trouble dealing with the leader of the palace guard. With the back of his hand, he knocked Sir Justice to the ground, sent the man's sword skittering across the floor and out of reach. The cat picked up Sir Justice and swiped him with a claw.
"No!"
Before Alice could stop him, Dodge bolted out from under the table, snatched up his father's sword, and attacked the cat.
Yah!
The assassin merely grinned, knocking him to the ground with a light blow. Six white chessmen converged on him and kept him from finishing off the boy. His right cheek bleeding from the four parallel cuts left by the cat's claws, Dodge hunched over his dead father, sobbing. Alice, alone under the table, also started to cry. Tears had been wetting her cheeks from the beginning, but they'd seemed to belong to somebody else, not a part of her, as if her body were responding to the horrific scene before her brain could comprehend it. Now she entered into grief, shaking with the force of her sobs.
"Sir Justice dead, Dodge abandoning me. Why did Father ever leave? And where's Mother? Where's—"
A face appeared before her. Colourless, sunken eyes, ravaged and diseased-looking skin, matted hair.
"Hello, niece."
Alice felt herself lifted out from under the table, held aloft by her long black hair.
"So you were to be queen, were you?"
The woman snorted, unimpressed.
"Aunt Red?" "None other."
"Let her go, Red." It was Genevieve.
"Are you telling me what to do?" Red sneered. "Look around. The time for giving orders is over."
"Please, let her go."
Red became impatient.
"You know I won't. You brought this on yourself, Queen Genevieve. I can't afford to leave any hearts alive. Except myself, obviously."
"You can have me instead."
"Stupid sister, I already have you. And by the way, if you're still expecting your king, I regret to inform you that he won't be returning home. Ever."
Red Scepter issued forth a cloud of red smoke, in the middle of which flickered a series of images. King Nolan and his men ambushed as they approached Hart Palace, Red marching up to the king and killing him with a sharp, knobbly scepter.
"Father!"
Alice cried.
"Oh, my sweet king!"
Genevieve gasped, and sent 18 steel-tipped cones, each with a point as sharp as a dagger, zooming toward Red, who lazily raised a hand. The cones froze in mid-air, then clumped on the floor. The heavy chandelier above Red's head came loose and fell toward her. Red made as if to brush a gnat from in front of her face, and the chandelier crumbled to dust.
"Is that the best you can do, sister?"
Red scoffed. A series of double-edged spears cartwheeled toward her. She knocked them aside one by one, bored with her own strength, tired of Genevieve's pestering.
"Playtime's over," she hissed.
Red pressed her index finger against the ball of her thumb, and Alice started to choke. It felt as if her throat had swollen shut. It didn't matter that her mother had failed. She herself had to think of something, to imagine something. But she couldn't focus. A wheel of cheese rolled against Red's foot. A pair of slippers danced in the air.
Red laughed. You were to be queen with an imagination like that?
Alice thought she was going to explode from lack of air. She fumbled with the jabberwock tooth hanging on her necklace and jabbed the pointed end into Red's forearm as hard as she could. It stuck.
Ah!
Red released her grip and Alice dropped to the floor. Before she'd even sucked in one lungful of air, she and her mother were racing down a hall, their feet barely touching the ground. They charged into the Queen's private rooms, past the couches and overstuffed chairs, past the royal outfits hanging in the wardrobe, and headed for the bathroom, where the cat stepped in front of them, lunged. It looked like the end for both of them, but something whirred past the princess's head and thump into the cat's chest. The cat fell at their feet. Hatter stepped over the beast and removed his top hat from the fatal wound.
Take Alice and go! Queen Genevieve said, pointing at the looking glass, as far away as possible.
But your majesty...
I'll follow you if and when I can. You have to keep the princess safe until she's old enough to rule. She's the only chance Wonderland has to survive. Promise me.
Hatter bowed his head. His life's mission was to protect the queen. So long as Genevieve lived, he should remain and fight the enemy. But he understood that Wonderland's future depended on Alice's survival. The queendom was more important than any single queen. He lifted his eyes to Genevieve's.
I promise, he said.
Genevieve knelt down in front of her daughter.
No matter what happens, I will always be near you, sweetheart, on the other side of the looking glass. And never, ever forget who you are. Do you understand?
I want to stay with you.
I know, Alice. I love you.
No, I'm staying.
Alice threw her arms around her mother. A wall crashed down and there stood Red with a platoon of card soldiers behind her.
Oh, how sweet. Let's have a group hug,
she said, moving toward them, hardly looking like the hugging type. Hatter grabbed Alice and jumped into the looking glass. Genevieve smashed the glass with her scepter and turned to face Red, unable to believe it when in her peripheral vision she saw the cat, on the floor with a gaping hole in his chest, open his eyes. His wound healed and he jumped at her. It all happened in an instant. Genevieve conjured a white bolt of energy from her imagination and thrust it into the cat, killing him a second time. The card soldiers stepped forward to attack the queen, but Red stopped them. She yanked the jagged bolt out of the cat and twirled it like a baton. It turned red in her hand.
Well, sister, what can I say? I'd be lying if I didn't say that I'm tickled to death to see you go.
She slammed the bolt into the floor. Dozens of black roses sprouted from the point of impact, their thorny stems wrapping themselves around Genevieve, pricking her skin and binding her fast. The rose petals opened and closed, toothy mouths eager for a bite of royal flesh.
Off with your head,
Red ordered, pulling the energy bolt out of the floor.
No!
Genevieve struggled against the stems of the roses. Her people would be abandoned to Red.
And Alice, just a child.
Red swung the bolt hard. Genevieve's head went one way, her body another, and her crown rolled along the floor like a dropped coin. Red picked up the crown and put it on her own head.
The queen is dead. Long live the queen. Me.
The platoon of renegade soldiers cheered. Red kicked the cat where he lay on the floor, tongue lolling in his mouth, the picture of death.
Get up. You still have 7 more lives.
The cat's eyes fluttered open.
Find Alice and kill her.
With a wave of her hand, the looking glass was once again whole. The cat jumped through, in pursuit of the only living heart besides Red. Chapter 11. Crystal Transport, also known as Looking Glass Transport, was not unusual in Wonderland. Most looking glasses served as portals to the Crystal Continuum, a network of byways that enabled any and every Wonderlander to enter through one looking glass and exit from another. Focused looking glasses led to specific destinations, like the corner of Wondertropolis Way and Tymon Street. Unfocused looking glasses allowed travellers to choose their own destinations, provided that there were looking glasses at those destinations out of which they could be reflected. In Queendom Speramus states, "As a body underwater tends to rise to the surface, a body entering a looking glass wants to be reflected out. It took practice to stay inside the continuum and master basic navigational skills. An inexperienced traveller might enter a looking glass in his own home, thinking to pay a visit to a friend across town, only to be reflected out of a looking glass at his next-door neighbour's house.
Sorry.
The traveller might then enter his next-door neighbour's looking glass, only to be reflected out at the house next door to his next-door neighbour, and so on until he reached his friend across town. Given time and experience, he would be able to make the trip with fewer stops. Covering long distances in the Crystal Continuum was tough, nearly impossible for all but the most experienced traveller. But short trips were within the skill range of everyone. The looking glass in the Queen's private rooms, however, was not linked to the rest of the continuum. It was a focused glass to be used for emergencies by the royal family and their intimates. It deposited the traveller deep in a forest. The exit glass was well camouflaged by a tight-lipped shrub. Having entered the continuum, Alice glanced back to see the wavering image of her mother growing progressively smaller among the brilliant crystalline surfaces along which she and Hatter travelled. Her mother exploded into a thousand fragments, jagged bits of Genevieve fluttering separately.
"Mother!"
And then there was nothing but blackness. It seemed like the end of everything. A black void rushed up behind them, as happened when a focused looking glass was destroyed, its path to a specific destination obliterated.
Where was she being taken? Where?
Closer and closer the void came, gaining on them, and then she awoke. Still in Hatter's arms, her cheek bouncing against his shoulder. Portal sleep was a side effect of looking glass transport among the young and inexperienced. Alice and Hatter were no longer in the continuum. They raced through a pitch-dark wood. Alice could see nothing ahead of her or behind, and she wouldn't even have known they were in a wood if she hadn't heard the whispering voices of the trees all around. It started to rain, to thunder and lightning. The wind picked up. How could Hatter see where he was going? From overhead she heard the sound of screaming, pain-riddled banshees.
"Seekers,"
Hatter said, more to himself than to Alice.
Yes, seekers, alerting whoever was following them of their location. Because someone or something was definitely following them. Hatter could hear it speeding toward them through the underbrush, breaking branches and splashing through puddles in its headlong pursuit.
After what felt to Alice like a lifetime, the whispering woods opened onto a wide expanse and they came to a precipice. It took her a second to realize where she was. The cliff overlooking the Pool of Tears, where she and Dodge had stood only a short time earlier. How she wished Dodge were with her now. The water was dark and roiling. All at once, she understood.
"No one ever comes back," she said, looking forlornly into the pool.
"But you will," said Hatter. "You have to."
Which was when the cat burst into the clearing and sprang at them, his arms extended. Hatter jumped. The cat snagged the sleeve of the princess's birthday dress, tearing it off with his claws. but that was all he got. Alice Hart, holding tight to Hatter Madigan, plummeted toward the surface of the water below. Chapter 12.
Point your feet down,
Hatter shouted, holding himself as straight as he could. He knew that if he and Alice didn't hit the water with as little impact as possible, it would be like landing on a sheet of diamond and they'd be killed. Alice barely had time to do as he instructed before they shot deep into the pool. She lost her grip on the millinery man. He reached for her, but she panicked, flailing, and then she was out of reach. Falling deeper underwater, she opened her eyes, saw nothing but foam and a rush of bubbles, and shut them again, not wanting to face the unknown. Just when she thought that she couldn't hold her breath any longer and would drown in the depths, she stopped and reversed directions, heading up toward the surface with the same force and speed as her descent.
Whoosh!
She was out of the water and in the air, cannonballing out of a dirty puddle in the middle of a street where a parade was taking place. People dressed in various shades of dull, with strange anonymous faces, were crowding the pavements and applauding her.
All these jumping and spinning and juggling people. And are those soldiers?
She had been mistaken for a member of a gypsy troupe tumbling and twirling and performing magic tricks alongside a marching regiment.
Bravo! Bravo!
The crowd applauded. Five bowler hats, an ivory-tipped cane, a pair of tortoiseshell eyeglasses, a rolled-up newspaper, a potato, and two plates of steak and kidney pie took to the air and circled overhead. The rolled-up newspaper smacked into a boy sitting on his father's shoulders. One woman ended up with a pie in her face. Dazed, Alice didn't even realize it was her imagination that had caused the objects to take flight. She was keeping her eye on the dirty puddle, hoping Hatter would appear. Then a gilded, open carriage, pulled by eight horses decked out in jeweled harnesses, splashed through the puddle, and she caught a glimpse of a woman, a queen. Surely it was a queen, inside, waving to the crowds.
Mother!
It was possible. Genevieve might have arrived in this world before her.
If anyone could do it.
And maybe being a queen in one world meant you were recognized as such in another. Alice forgot about the dirty puddle and chased after the carriage, at which point the bowler hats, eyeglasses, cane, potato and steak and kidney pie dropped to the ground.
Mother! Mother! Wait!
She weaved her way through the parading soldiers toward the Queen's carriage. The soldiers bumped and elbowed her.
Get lost, brat! Away with you, dirty urchin!
She hardly noticed. She was gaining on the carriage.
Her mother would see her, order her lifted up onto the equipage's plush cushion, and they would be reunited.
The awfulness of the last half hour explained to her.
It had been a test, Genevieve would say. Alice's first test as future queen and nothing more.
She was within 100 feet of the carriage when, having reached the end of the parade route, it abruptly turned into a side street and picked up speed. The entrance to the street blocked by a line of soldiers to prevent anyone from following. With as much pride as she could muster, armed with a firm belief in her own entitlement, she was a princess. Alice approached the soldiers standing guard.
Where is that carriage going?
No answer. Maybe they hadn't heard her. She was about to ask again when one of the soldiers deigned to look in her direction, and judging by the look on his face, as if someone had shoved a smelly radish under his nose, he was not impressed by Alice's rough and tumble appearance. Alice glanced down at her dress, torn by the cat and wet from the pool of tears. She looked far from regal.
To Buckingham Palace, where'd you think? He said.
But Alice wasn't thinking. Events still following too closely and too quickly, one after another, for her to make much sense of them. Buckingham Palace was simply the place where her mother had gone.
And where is the palace? She asked.
You don't know where Buckingham Palace is?
If you don't tell me, I can make life difficult for you.
This amused the soldier. That right? And why should I tell you where the palace is? Like as not you're after doing the Queen some harm.
I am Princess Alice Hart. The Queen is my mother, and...
You're... Well, well. The soldier turned to the fellow standing next to him, who had overheard everything. Hey, George, this girl here says her mother's the Queen.
You don't say,
said George, turning to the soldier next to him.
Timothy, you hear that? This little girl's mother's the Queen. You and me'd have to die protecting her, I suppose.
All hail the royal lady, Timothy said, bowing.
The soldiers laughed. Nothing was worse than imagination used in the service of anger, Alice knew. But these soldiers were too disrespectful. It may have been the distorting properties of her anger, or the muck of this alien city, but when she imagined the soldiers' mouths sewn shut, their coats and breeches tore at the seams instead. Thinking they had split their uniforms from laughing so hard, the soldiers laughed even harder. Alice's anger drained out of her, leaving her sad and doubtful. Could it be that her mother hadn't been in the carriage? Hadn't she seen her mother burst into a thousand fragments, leaving only blackness, nothingness in her place? And why had her imagination failed her? Without realizing it, she walked away from the soldiers.
Hatter!
She called. But there were only strangers, clots of them conversing on the pavements, others hurrying on their way to who knew where. There was only the grime and soot and horse dung stink of the streets.
Hatter!
She had to get back to the puddle that had landed her in this world. It could reunite her with Hatter, maybe even return her to Wonderland. She retraced her steps. But the street was mottled with so many puddles. What if she'd gone too far and passed it? Everything appeared equally unfamiliar. Could she have covered so much distance while chasing the carriage? What if she never found the puddle? What would happen when the sun broke through the clouds? If she stopped to think about what she was going through... No, don't! Her father murdered, her mother most likely dead, Sir Justice Anders' throat torn open, and Dodge, her best friend... But don't think about it, don't! Stuck in this alien place, alone, don't... She had to be strong. She was a princess, the future queen of Wonderland. She shouldn't weep like a baby. She took a running start toward the nearest puddle, jumped, and landed in the middle of it, splashing herself and a lady and gentleman walking past.
Oh, good heavens,
the woman protested. The man made as if to chase after Alice, but she had already stamped out of the puddle and was sprinting toward another. She jumped into it and thoroughly soaked a dapper young chap who'd just come from a visit with his tailor.
Oh! This cravat alone is worth more than you, you beastly thing!
Alice splashed from puddle to puddle, squeezing shut her eyes as she took to the air and imagining hard that she was back in Wonderland, opening her eyes as she came down, sprays of water going every which way, only to find that she was still in this alien world.
I'll never find my way home. Never, ever, ever.
All hope gone, she jumped up and down in a single puddle, yelling,
No, no, no!
Until it was impossible to tell which were her tears and which splotches of street water.
You taking a bath or what?
Said a boy, watching from a safe distance, out of splashing range. She stopped jumping, sniffed. The boy wore grey breeches, patched at the knees and thighs, a frock coat much too big for him, the tail of which reached down practically to his heels, and cracked leather boots with no laces.
I'm Princess Alice Hart of Wonderland, she said defiantly.
Yeah, and I'm Prince Quigley Gaffer of Chelsea. That's one loony outfit you're wearing.
She looked down at her damp, dirty birthday dress, a flouncy thing tight at the waist and poofing out below her knees in a cumbersomely wide circle, its collar high and floppy and ruffled. It was decorated with appliqued hearts, in colours only available in Wonderland, and the dress was a rare sight even there, where it would be taken from the princess's wardrobe and aired only once a year, the royal tailors refitting it to accommodate Alice's growing body.
"It's all I have," she said, which started her crying again.
Quigley considered her for a moment. Even smudged with dirt and scum and with tears leaking out of her eyes, there was something about the girl that intrigued him. She seemed brighter than everything around her. It was as if she were lit from within by a lantern that shone faintly through the pores of her skin.
"Better come with me if you want dry clothes, Your Majesty," he said.
He started to walk off. Alice hesitated. Half a block away, Quigley turned.
"Off we go,"
he called, waving for her to follow. She looked around one last time for Hatter, then abandoned her puddle. She couldn't afford not to have a friend.
Chapter 13. No amount of millinery training could have prepared Hatter for getting sucked through the pool of tears. Having somersaulted out of a puddle and landed on his feet with the agility of, well, of a cat, he let his instinct for self-protection take over. His backpack sprouted its usual array of weaponry. His steel bracelets popped open and spun in propeller-like action. He reached for his top hat, but it was gone, which was bad news, really bad news. The top hat was his signature weapon, the one he had worked the hardest to master. And he was probably going to need it, judging by the shocked and alarmed faces all around him. He had emerged from the exit portal in Paris, France, 1859, and found himself standing in the middle of a wide thoroughfare known as the Champs-Élysées. Parisians spilled their café au lait at the sight of him. His sudden appearance upset traffic, carriages veering left and right. One carriage knocked over a fruit stand, another crushed baskets of baguettes and loaves. Horses whinnied and neighed, edgy. Who was this strangely attired man, with knives and oversized corkscrews jutting out of his backpack, and rotary blades on his wrists? Hatter kept an eye on the puddle, expecting the cat or red soldiers to spring from it at any moment.
"Alice!"
But she was nowhere to be seen. This was worse than not having his top hat. In the pool of tears for hardly any time at all, with only one job to do, one simple job, to look after the future Queen of Wonderland, and he'd let her fall away from him. She must have been sucked through the portal to another location. Men were coming toward him, men in uniforms and small firm caps with brims, looking confused and more than a little frightened. He snapped his wrist blades closed and ran, not because he was afraid of them, but because he was afraid of what he might do to them. Even here, in another world, he would abide by the codes of Wonderland's millinery, which stated that combat skills were not to be used on a person until he was a proven enemy, and even then only to the extent that they were necessary. Plus, it was best to draw as little attention to himself as possible, to disappear into the underground in order to find Princess Alice. His millinery coat swooped out behind him as he cut across the Champs-Élysées and down a residential street. He was faster and more agile than the Frenchmen, and would have easily escaped their pursuit if he'd known his way around Paris. Time and again he thought he'd lost them, that they were no longer following him, only to discover that they must have taken a shortcut through an alley, because now they were in front of him. He had to get rid of them for good. He stopped running and let them approach. When they were within 10 paces of him, he flicked open his wrist blades, feinted at them, and they scattered into cafes, brasseries, patisseries and boulangeries, lunging for safety anywhere they could find it. Hatter snapped shut his wrist blades and ran, and this time they didn't follow. He hid under a bridge on the banks of the Seine until nightfall, when he could more easily move through the city undetected. He planned to canvass the streets, search every lane and alley for the princess before moving on to another town or city. He would get maps, systematically scour this entire world if necessary, familiarize himself with intercity routes, pass across borders like a phantom. His promise to Genevieve, the queen he'd left behind, demanded it. Under the blanket of darkness, he made his way up and down streets, starting at one end of the city and working his way across it. And now that he had an opportunity to notice, Hatter saw that some people had a glow about them. Supposing them suffused with the luminescence of imagination, he followed one glowing man down the Rue de Rivoli to a modest shop with a wooden sign in the shape of a top hat hanging over its door. It could have been a station for the millinery men and women of the city. Perhaps he would find camaraderie and assistance here. He followed the man into the shop. It was filled with every variety of hat. Derbies, bowlers, tams, fezzes, berets, an array of headwear that impressed even Hatter. He picked up one of the top hats and flicked it, but it held its innocent shape. A diminutive gentleman with a wispy moustache approached.
Bonjour, monsieur. Est-ce que je peux vous aider?
I come from Wonderland, Hatter said. I oversee the millinery there. He waited, hoping the meaning, the import of this, would make itself felt to the shopkeeper.
Cela est un bon chapeau,
the man said, pointing to the top hat. Hatter set down the item.
I am searching for Princess Alice Hard of Wonderland. She has landed somewhere in this world, as I have, through a portal, and...
But the shopkeeper's eyes showed no recognition at Alice's name, no understanding of what Hatter was saying. When the man tried to show Hatter the merits of a certain beret, Hatter left the shop. He would try others, however. He trusted those who dealt in headwear more than he trusted anyone else. A few doors down, three men emerged from a cafe, tipsy with drink. They stopped in bleary-eyed surprise at the sight of Hatter, his odd-looking clothes.
Je n'aime pas les étrangers,
one of the men said. Hatter didn't have to understand French to hear the hostility in his voice. The man pretended to punch Hatter, and his companions laughed. Hatter didn't flinch.
I don't want to fight you, he said.
No?
No.
The man shoved Hatter, who stood his ground, an exemplar of restraint.
Qu'est-ce qu'il y a dans le sac?
The man asked, indicating Hatter's backpack.
Donnez-moi le sac.
The man took a step toward Hatter, reached for the backpack. Only an enemy would try to take Hatter's weapons. Activating his wrist blades, the milliner flipped backwards to give himself some space. He reached into his backpack and let fly with a handful of daggers. Thimp, thimp, thimp. The daggers pinned the men to a wooden cart by their shirt sleeves. A feat of martial skill, Hatter hoped would show that he could kill all three of them if he so desired. More men appeared, spilling out of the nearby cafes, alarmed. They surrounded Hatter, 15 of them. One of them aimed a pistol at his head. Hatter vaguely recognized the pistol as something invented by a Wonderlander during his boyhood. To reacquaint himself with its capabilities, he eyed the man and said,
"Boo!"
Panicked, the man fired. A round steel bullet shot toward Hatter, but with the speed of a jabberwock's tongue, he ducked, and it whizzed past. Hatter punched a button on his belt buckle, and a series of curved saber blades flicked open along the surface of his belt. But before the blades sliced into action, the group scattered, each man running as far from Hatter as he could get. Which didn't stop them from later reporting that they had witnessed the menacing figure kill upwards of 20 innocent civilians with his elaborate weaponry, themselves living to tell about it only by the grace of God. The sabers on Hatter's belt retracted. He snapped his wrist blades closed and allowed himself a brief smile, relieved that he hadn't had to kill anyone. He didn't see the large, elaborately decorated rug closing in on him, held up from behind by six of Paris's bravest carpet salesmen. The rug knocked him down, and the men rolled him up tight in it. His backpack weaponry poked through the thick pile, but his arms were pinned to his sides. He was unable to reach his belt buckle or flick his wrists to activate his deadly bracelets. Hoisting the rug-cocooned hatter onto their shoulders, the men hauled him off to the Palais de Justice. But as he breathed in the rug's fibres, Hatter's concern wasn't for his own safety, but for that of Alice Hart, a lost princess in a hostile world. Chapter 14. The cat stood at the edge of the cliff and stared down at the foaming, rippling spot where Alice and Hatter had splashed into the water. Lightning flashed, thunder broke overhead, and rain fell in sheets. If there was one thing the cat didn't like, it was water. Rain, showers, baths, it didn't matter which. He hated getting wet. He turned and stalked back into the forest with the scrap of Alice's dress in his fist.
"You let them get away,"
a voice said. The cat stopped, tense.
"They escaped,"
said another. He spun round but saw no one. The forest was talking to him, the trees and plants and flowers.
"What's the matter?"
asked a nearby lilac bush.
"Afraid to take a dip in the water?"
The forest had a good laugh at that, but the cat didn't appreciate the teasing. He bent down and tore the lilac up by its roots and threw it on the ground. The forest fell silent. The cat walked up to a tree.
"Were you talking to me?"
The tree said nothing. The cat glanced to his left, then right.
"I don't see anyone else here, so you must have been talking to me."
Still, the tree said not a word. It didn't matter. The cat raked his claws down its trunk, skinning off the bark.
"Ow!"
the tree cried. The cat re-entered the crystal continuum through the forest looking glass, its guard, the tight-lipped shrub, now more tight-lipped than ever, and re-emerged in Genevieve's sitting room. He hulked through the destruction of the sitting area and down a heart-shaped passage to the south dining room, stepping over dead card soldiers and guardsmen as if they had never been alive at all, never beings who laughed, cried, rejoiced, or had loved ones waiting for them at home. Notwithstanding the blast that had rocked the palace, the bodies splayed in all manner of death on the tables and floor, the south dining room was a scene of celebration. Red's soldiers helped themselves to wonder crumpets, fried dormice, and whatever other delicacies they could find, and none too delicately shoved them into their mouths. Not being much interested in tea, they raided the palace's wine cellar, and now flooded their bellies with goblet after goblet of the Queendom's finest wine.
"To the health of Queen Red!"
"To the death of Queen Genevieve!"
These toasts were one and the same to Red, who was lounging in a chair wearing the bloody crown.
"Well,"
she said when she saw the cat,
"where are their heads?"
One didn't admit failure to Red and get away with it without suffering pain, or worse. The cat held up the shred of Alice's dress.
"This is all that's left of them. I'm sorry, Your Highness, I couldn't control myself."
"It's unwise to control yourself in a situation like that," Red said.
"Well done."
But a scheming, dishonest mind such as Red's always suspects others of scheming and dishonesty. She tried to see Alice in her imagination's eye, to discover the truth for herself. Nothing. Imagination could not penetrate the pool of tears, which was lucky for the cat.
"She's dead," said a voice from behind a curtain. "Alice is dead."
Red waved her hand and the curtain swung back to reveal Bibwit Hare.
"If it isn't my wise and learned tutor," she said.
Bibwit Hare was a loyal fellow, and it was because of his loyalty to Genevieve and Alice and White Imagination that he determined then and there to ensure his own survival by appeasing Red. Though a scholar, he vowed to one day topple this mistress of black imagination and return Wonderland to the glory of peace. He bowed his head.
At your service, your imperial viciousness?
Red sneered.
Your imperial viciousness? Ha! Yes, that's perfect! From now on, everyone will refer to me as your imperial viciousness, or die. You there?
Yes, my queen.
A two-card started, but was immediately pierced through the lung by one of the cat's claws.
You,
Red said to a three-card.
Yes, your imperial viciousness?
I want a list of those considered sympathetic to the former queen who are not dead in this room. I am aware that General Doppelganger is not among the bodies here. Begin the list with him. For the rest, ask them.
She turned her gaze upon the suit families, who stood clustered together, trying to take up as little space as possible.
I'm sure they'll be helpful.
Oh, yes,
declared the Lord of Diamonds, still with a hand on Jack of Diamonds' shoulder.
Absolutely,
said the Lady of Spades.
Of course, by all means, said the Lady of Clubs and her husband.
Red was not an idiot. She knew that she couldn't rule the queendom by fear and intimidation alone. The suit families had relationships with mayors of principalities and influential businessmen, with key members of what remained of the queendom's military force, relationships that would have to be exploited for her profit and exaltation.
There are to be some changes in the queendom which may prove beneficial to you all,
her imperial viciousness announced,
not the least of which is that since I have no heirs of heart descent, nor do I want any, I will choose my successor from one of the ranking families. Whoever among you serves me best can be assured of nothing, but you will at least have a better chance at the crown than the others.
She ventured a smile, which the Lady of Spades, for one, found more gruesome than many of the lifeless bodies surrounding her, and which, if truth be told, it physically hurt Red to accomplish.
I trust you don't mind my preying on your ambitions in this way?
Oh, no, declared the Lord of Diamonds. Absolutely not, said the Lady of Spades.
By all means, no,
said the Lady of Clubs and her husband. The suit family struggled to remember who had escaped, mentioning pawns, a rook, a knight, numerous card soldiers.
Dodge Anders has escaped,
Jack of Diamonds asserted, louder than the others.
And who might Dodge Anders be?
Asked Red.
He is in love with Princess Alice, but pretends not to be. He is a guardsman's son. That's his father there.
Jack pointed to Sir Justice, lying dead on the floor. Red approached the boy. The rogue soldiers paused in the midst of their celebrations. The cat stood motionless. No one knew what Red might do.
You're a helpful one, aren't you?
She said, squeezing his cheeks like a loving grandmother. Jack couldn't answer because of her grip.
Add Dodge Anders' name to the list, she commanded, and released Jack of Diamonds.
Small bruises formed where her fingers had touched his cheeks. She removed the crown from her head and tossed it to Bibwit.
Prepare for my coronation at the Heart Crystal. Now! All members of ranking families must attend, unless, of course, they prefer the comfort of eternal sleep.
Surrounded by Bibwit Hare, the cat, the suit families, those of her soldiers who were not too drunk to remain upright, and some who were, Red stood in the palace courtyard before the Heart Crystal and lifted her voice to the lightning storm sky.
I am prepared to forgive those who thrived during my exile
and did little to support my return, with this exception. Anyone harbouring or aiding a creature sympathetic to the former queen or white imagination will be hunted down, imprisoned, made to suffer untold tortures, and then executed. Now, put the crown on my head. Bibwit Hare stepped forward to fulfil the request, but fast as he was, he proved not fast enough for Red. With a curl of her finger, the crown leaped from his hands and landed on her head.
I reclaim my queendom, she declared, placing both hands on the heart crystal.
A jolt of energy shook her. The crystal turned from white to red, a red so deep and piercing that Bibwit and the others had to turn away or close their eyes to prevent their pupils from scorching. Red had claimed the power of the heart crystal as her own.
Chapter 15. Generals Doppel and Ganger and the few who survived Red's attack avoided the crystal continuum in case the invading force had already taken control of its shimmering byways. They made their way on foot to the Everlasting Forest, found refuge in a small clearing surrounded by trees that would alert them of approaching enemies. The healthy carried the wounded, but all suffered emotionally from their defeat and the loss of beloved left behind.
We must organize quickly, General Doppel urged. Before Red settles into her rule, agreed General Ganger.
The White Knight nodded.
Our only chance to amass an army is now, Doppel continued, however ill-timed such recruitment may be.
The three turned their eyes toward the battle-numbed card soldiers, dragging themselves into the sanctuary of the forest.
My bishops and I are prepared to risk everything for the good of the queendom, said the knight. We will find Wonderlanders to fight with us against Red, you can rest assured.
The knight gathered his bishops and their pawns.
Spread out through the capital city, he ordered. Find anyone willing to fight for white imagination and tell them where we're camped. They must make their own careful way to us. But be sure they're sincere in their wish to join our cause, or you will give us away and we'll be doomed.
Among the soldiers gathering in the forest sat one who wasn't a soldier at all. Just an inconsolable boy slumped against the base of a tree, crying in fits and jags and not caring if Red herself heard him. The generals would have known better how to subdue a raging jabberwock than a mourning child.
You should never have brought me here, Dodge moaned. I shouldn't have left them.
There was nothing you could do, son. General Doppel said. You would have been killed, said General Ganger.
At least I would have died alongside my father. I could have protected Alice.
If Hatter couldn't...
Then no one could have provided protection enough, I'm afraid.
Dodge wiped his nose.
We are sorry,
Generals Doppel and Ganger said as one.
I've lost my father and... And Alice...
The generals lowered their heads, took a moment to speak.
We have all lost Princess Alice, and feel your suffering on that score.
Dodge doubted it. They couldn't possibly know how he felt. The pain, the sudden wretched loneliness. They might have lost their princess, but Alice was so much more than that to him. Would he never more see lively, sweet-smelling Alice Hart? Never again confide to her his dreams of soldier fame? What good were dreams now?
And then his father, he could hardly take it all in. He would never see his father again.
Where the two greatest loves of his life had been, he was faced with nothing. Blankness.
We are sorry.
The general said again. But they had what remained of their army to comfort. They left him and strode among their soldiers, dispensing words of consolation to the wounded and commendations of bravery to all. Dodge didn't remember falling asleep, wasn't aware that he'd even been sleeping,
until he awoke the next morning with a sudden start, an idea blazing in his brain and the resolve to carry it through already firm. When the generals came upon him, he was ripping the fleur-de-lis badge off his guardsman coat, and they watched as he put his coat on inside out and rubbed handfuls of dirt over himself until it became virtually impossible to tell that he wore a guardsman's uniform.
"What are you up to?" General Doppel asked.
"If it's too late to do anything for Alice, there's at least something I can still do for my father."
The generals exchanged a worried glance.
"I'm going to get his body," Dodge said. "The leader of the palace guard deserves a burial proper to his station, and I'm going to give it to him."
"You can't go back there," General Ganger said.
"Why not?"
"Well," said General Doppel, "who's to say that Sir Justice's body is even still there? And..."
"And red soldiers are everywhere," General Ganger finished. "You'll never make it."
"I'm going."
"But we forbid it.
Dodge Anders had always shown respect for chains of command, for the discipline required of military men. But he suddenly barked.
"Who are you to forbid it? Do you have Anders' blood in your veins?"
"I'll go with him if it makes you feel better, generals."
The White Rook. Dodge felt his heart thumping in his throat. He was breathing short and fast. The chessman came and stood next to him. It was all right. Dodge didn't know the rook well, but it was all right. It would be good to have company. The generals shook their heads, couldn't help being impressed by the boy's character despite the foolishness of the proposed errand. In silent agreement, they removed the exact same crystal and gemstone quadruple heart medal from their uniforms and presented them to Dodge. "With utmost respect for your father," General Doppel said.
"Please give him these," said General Ganger.
Dodge took the medals in his hand and pocketed them carefully. He could feel his bottom lip quivering. He turned and hurried into the woods.
"Take care of him,"
the generals told the chessman. The rook knew he would be easy to spot in the capital city, so as he left the encampment, he grabbed a blanket and draped it over his battlements to give himself the appearance of an anonymous pauper. Silent, alert, he and Dodge made their way to Hart Palace. They found Wondertropolis practically deserted. Small clans of red soldiers lolled outside abandoned cafes, drunk on wine, and harassing the few Wonderlanders who braved the streets, hurrying to their destinations with lowered heads, intent on keeping to their own business. Dodge and the Rook cut this way and that through the city, avoiding the soldiers. They made it to the palace without incident, surprised to find it unguarded, unmanned.
"Where's the heart crystal?"
the Rook asked. Dodge paused to study the courtyard. How gloomy it was, forsaken and without the light of the powerful crystal. Suddenly a figure scurried out of the palace. Dodge and the Rook reached for their swords, but there was no need. The figure, a male, didn't seem to notice them. Arms laden with goblets and dishes, he ran past and was gone. Another Wonderlander trotted out of the palace and through the courtyard carrying a music box and several pillows. Dodge looked at the Rook. What was going on? In the palace's darkened halls, they discovered looters moving about in silent hurry, helping themselves to souvenirs of the former ruling family. A Wonderlander ran past with one of Alice's old toys in his arms, a set of Glogwormies. Dodge made a move to trip the thief, but the Rook put a hand on his arm and shook his head. Dodge had to focus on what he'd come to do. As flitting as the looters, Dodge and the Rook drifted through the banquet rooms and salons. They saw a great many of Red soldiers passed out on the floors and tables, but no sign of Red or the cat. They drew closer to the south dining room, stepped over dead card soldiers and guardsmen.
"That smell!"
Dodge clamped a hand over his nose. "It'll be worse inside," the Rook said. They found the dining room deserted, the stench too much for the looters. The rook paused just inside the room, shaking his battlement-topped head at the carnage. But as ghastly as the scene was, Dodge saw only his father's body. He stood over Sir Justice and cried silent tears. "We should hurry," the rook said gently. Dodge wiped his face and nodded, more to himself than to the rook, a nod to convince himself that he had the strength to do this. They carried Sir Justice out to the garden, and using broken chair backs as shovels, began to dig. It wasn't easy going. They sweated, their muscles ached. But the hole was at last large enough. Once Sir Justice was lying in the ground, Dodge removed from his pocket the medals the generals had given him, and he laid them on his father's chest. With timid, unsteady hands, he began to shovel soil into the grave.
No! It was impossible! Worse than anything he'd ever experienced, to see the soil fall on his father, the man who had given him life. A cry burst from him. He threw his makeshift shovel to the ground, ran and hid in a corner of the garden. How could he live? Why should he live when those he had held most dear did not?
He became quiet, subdued. How and why should he live? These were questions to be answered. The only questions. When he finally stepped out from his hiding place, Sir Justice was buried. The rook had taken care of everything. Almost. "Would you like to do this?" the rook asked, holding a seed out to Dodge, the hereafter seed. Dodge took the seed and dropped it on his father's grave. Instantly, the seed took root, and up grew a large, beautiful bouquet of flowers, the arrangement of which formed Sir Justice's likeness, a living memorial.
"Thank you," Dodge murmured.
The rook accepted the thanks in silence, detected no sign of tears on the boy's cheeks. Dodge's tight, squinting expression looked more angry than sad. They stood together over the grave in final tribute. "He was a good man," the rook said, "a brave and honourable man." Dodge snorted, bitter.
"Yeah, and this was his reward."
Chapter 16. Alice thought Quigley Gaffer the nicest in the band of homeless orphans and runaways of which he was a part, and not just because he was so attentive to her. He was attentive to everybody. He was the least sullen, the least prone to depression, the one who, with his lively, confident attitude, kept everyone's spirits up when there weren't enough crusts to go around, when it was cold and wet and they'd been chased out of too many sheltered doorways to count. In other words, Quigley Gaffer gave them hope when life seemed particularly hopeless. And he had suffered as much as anybody. Walking alongside Alice that first day in London, he said,
"So, Princess, tell us about yourself."
And she voiced her woeful condition with a viciousness that surprised her.
"I saw my father, the King of Wonderland, murdered. My mother, the Queen, is dead. Both of them were killed by my aunt. But it wouldn't matter even if they were alive, because I'll never make it home."
"I saw my folks murdered, same as you," said Quigley. "We were driving along in our coach, when a couple of thieves decided they didn't like the look of us and killed my father with a club to the head. I watched my mother get beaten to death with that self-same club, all the while begging for mercy. And I would have been greeted with the club too if I hadn't run into the dark and hidden while the thieves were trying to take the rings off Mother's fingers. So I suppose you and me have something in common. What with our parents being dead, right enough?"
Alice could think of other things she would have rather had in common with him. She didn't know it, and this certainly wasn't how Bibwit Hare would have taught her. But in the person of Quigley Gaffer, Alice was learning something that would one day serve her well as a queen. Lesson number 1B in Bibwit's carefully planned curriculum. For most of the universe's inhabitants, life is not all gummy wads and tarty tarts. It is a struggle against hardship, unfairness, corruption, abuse, and adversity in all its guises, where even to survive, let alone survive with dignity, is heroic. To soldier through the days in the wake of failure is the courageous act of many. To rule benevolently, a queen should be able to enter into the feelings of those less fortunate than herself.
"Never mind that dress. I knew from your gab that you ain't from anywhere round here," Quigley said.
"You don't have any accent I recognise."
"I don't know just what it is."
"It's Wonderlandian, I suppose."
"Right, right. You're from Wonderland, you say?"
Quigley laughed.
"Why don't you tell us about the place, Princess?"
So she did. And the more she talked, the more she felt the cold, impersonal tone she'd used to describe her parents' deaths fall away, till she was almost overcome with sadness and longing for what so quickly and suddenly, so unexpectedly, had become part of her past. She was sure the Inventor's Parade wouldn't seem so boring to her now if she could only get back to the royal balcony to watch it.
"You see that light?" she said, pointing at one of the gas lamps lining the street. "That was invented in Wonderland. But instead of an open flame, it had a glass bulb inside, and you only had to flick a switch to turn it on."
She described Heart Palace, the singing flowers in the royal gardens, the crystal continuum.
"And I don't mean to brag," she said, "but I have a powerful imagination."
"I'll say.
You think I'm making everything up?"
Quigley didn't answer. Alice saw a lone dandelion poking out of some mud. She stared hard at the flower and imagined it singing. It seemed to require more effort than it would have done in Wonderland, and it took longer. But then the dandelion's petals moved, and from the bud at its centre came a thin little voice.
"La la 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 la, la 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 la, la 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 la."
That was all Alice could manage, but Quigley was impressed. He'd heard about magicians who could throw their voices, making it sound as if a person or object across a room were talking when it would be the magician himself standing right next to you.
"Nice trick."
"It's not a trick."
And then, sadly, just remembering, the exiled princess added,
"It's my birthday."
"Happy birthday, ma'am." Alice felt her eyes water, sorrow weighing her down.
"Oh, no crying on birthdays," Quigley said. "You ought to meet some of my friends. They'll cheer you right up."
So they walked to a blind alley in the shadow of London Bridge, where a ragtag group of children, ranging in age from 5 to 12, lounged around on old crates.
Hear ye, Quigley announced. "I bring a newcomer into our ranks."
The children looked at Alice uninterested. They had seen newcomers before. Fact was, the makeup of the group was always changing. Some boy or girl entering into it one day, sharing their bread for weeks or months, and then going off, never to be seen again. No one ever knowing if they'd been arrested for stealing, stuck in a home, murdered, or what. Quigley introduced everyone to Alice.
"The big one's Charlie Turnbull. The one next to him with the mole on his nose is Andrew McLean. He's an orphan too. That one there is Otis Oglethorpe, a runaway, but his mother's dead. And in the ladies we've got Francine Forge, Esther Wilkes and Margaret Blemin, all of them orphans. Everyone, may I present you with Princess Alice of Wonderland. She's come to us through a puddle of water, and I suggest you be on your best behaviour in front of royalty."
"Puddle of water?" Charlie Turnbull guffawed. "Princess of Wonderland?"
Quigley didn't bother to explain. He dug in a heap of what looked like rags and held up a pair of trousers, a blouse and a man's coat for Alice's approval.
These should fit you right enough.
Where was she supposed to change out of her wet things?
Sorry, Princess, said Quigley. No private rooms for you here in the alleys of London.
She stripped, trying to act as if taking off her clothes in front of everybody wasn't unusual. The blouse fit her well enough, but the trousers and coat were too large. She added her birthday dress to the pile of clothes and blankets for anyone who might want it once it was dry. She slipped her feet into a pair of boots Quigley had rummaged up for her, discarding her Wonderland birthday shoes.
Righty, right. Let's see what we got, Quigley said to the others.
They pulled various coins and foodstuffs out of their pockets. A few pence, a mostly empty wallet, cheese, sausages, a chicken leg. Otis Oglethorpe produced a loaf of bread he'd been hiding under his coat, and Charlie took half a meat pie from under his hat.
What about you?
Otis asked Quigley.
What have you brought? I brought the princess, right enough.
We can't eat her, said Charlie Turnbull. And that's another mouth eating what could have gone into our bellies.
I'll make it up tomorrow, when me and the princess will bring plenty for all of you. Don't worry.
Charlie glared at Alice. Meeting Quigley's friends wasn't in the least cheering. The food was divided evenly into 8 portions. The cheese and sausage did not taste like their counterparts in Wonderland. The cheese somehow soggy, the sausage flavourless. The meat pie, Alice thought, tasted like a stuffed old stocking. After eating, Andrew, Francine and Margaret, the youngest of the orphans, crowded together on the clothes heap and snuggled down to sleep. Charlie made a bed for himself by pushing 3 crates together and covering them with an old quilt. Otis simply went to bed on the hard ground, using his coat as a blanket. Esther Wilkes dozed off sitting up, leaning back against a wall, her legs sticking out straight in front of her into the alley. Alice couldn't sleep. She tried counting guinooks. 1 guinook, 2 guinook, 3 guinook. It didn't help.
"Restless, Princess?"
Quigley asked, and offered to keep her company for a bit.
"We scatter about during the day," he explained, "to beg, borrow or steal, as the case may be. Francine, Andrew and Margaret work as a team. 2 of them get a bloke's attention while a 3rd picks his pockets. Some days, one or another of us will make the rounds of the shops, looking for stale food they might want to throw away. But every night, we meet here and share what we've got. I don't know if it's easier on us to make our way together, and Charlie doesn't always give up everything he gets in a day. He doesn't know I know, so I don't tell him. But it feels better to most of them to be in a group. It can get lonely with no proper family." "I'm sure it can," said Alice. "Well, now," Quigley curled up on the ground, using his hands as a pillow. "Gotta get some sleep. I made a promise to the others, and tomorrow's going to be something big, I can tell you. I've got plans for us, you and me. Good night, Princess. Good night, Quigley Gaffer."
It wasn't long before Alice was alone with the steady, rhythmic breathing of the slumbering street urchins. Francine mumbled in her sleep and buried her face in the crook of Andrew's arm. Charlie started to snore. Alice turned her face to the sky, to the limitless expanse that ever since she could remember had served as a reminder of the wondrous possibilities open to her.
4 guinook, 5 guinook, 6.
Now starless and close, the sky just seemed empty.
7 guinook, 8 guinook, 9 guinook, 10.